This is James Turner for O'Reilly Media. I'm speaking today with Dr. Andrew Weaver, Canada Research Chair in Climate Modeling and Analysis in the School of Earth and Ocean Sciences at the University of Victoria. Dr. Weaver recently served as the lead author of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and is currently the chief editor of the Journal of Climate. Good day, and thank you for talking to us.
Thank you for having me on your show.
To begin, I'm curious what leads someone into a career as a climate researcher. You were doing your graduate work in the mid-80s when global warming was just beginning to appear on the radar, certainly not the, excuse the expression, hot topic that it is today. Did you have some inkling that this was going to be one of the consuming issues of the next century?
Absolutely not at the time. You know, my PhD is actually in mathematics, but I always have enjoyed trying to do relevant maths, that is, math that I feel is applicable to what happens on a daily basis. So my thesis was on atmosphere and mathematics applied to atmospheric and oceanic physics problems. And, you know, I worked on that in a couple of years. It wasn't until I did a postdoc at University of Washington in Seattle that I was steered into the climate problem by a guy there called Ed Sarachuk, quite a visionary at the time. And so it was back in 1989 that I got interested in the problem.
Talking a little bit about the current state of the art in climate modeling, it strikes me, is climate modeling a bit like a Hollywood CGI blockbuster in the sense that you need people who are really good at developing models, and then you also need people who are really good at implementing models, or do people come to the table who have, like, both skill sets?
No, you're absolutely right. A climate model basically is like a laboratory. It's a culmination of many, many hundreds of hours of work by people all over the world. So what you have there is you have people who go out and study the physics of some very particular process. For example, they might study how mixing occurs in the ocean, turbulence in the ocean. They might study cloud processes. Then you get others who try to represent those processes on a bigger scale. So, you know, what does it mean for that physics on a scale of, say, the size of a town? Others look at how different aspects of the system interact. How does ocean interact with atmosphere? And what you do is, you know, we're building fundamental understanding of nature, and then in the climate model, what you do is you start to put it all together. So, you know, I'm a kind of an end person, that is, I'm putting stuff together that other people have done the experiments in the field, and then looking, you know, making those projections both back into the past as well as into the future. But you certainly can't do everything as a climate scientist.
Right. But is there even in there a division between people who are developing the equations, for example, and the people who are actually writing the code?
Well, typically historically there has been, because there was a generation of scientists who basically got going when the computers weren't around. And so a lot of the early analysis in many fields of physics was theoretical, analytical. That is, it was equations without, you know, being able to truly solve them. But with the advent of the computer, now we're able to solve equations that you can't solve with pencil and paper. And so now the theoretician is equally versed with numerical computational solutions of these equations as they are with analytic solutions. So I think that distinction has in recent years moved away from being there.
Is there anything like an open source philosophy in climate modeling, or is kind of every team off in its own corner with its own model?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, our group here, I mean, we have something known as the Uvicker system climate model. That is open source. Anybody can have it and do whatever they want within reason, of course. And many groups are like that. It goes back to long, rich history of that stems from the NOAA Geophysical Fluid Dynamics Laboratory in Princeton, which have historically always made their ocean model code available. NCAR, National Center for Atmospheric Research in Boulder, have always made the climate system model available. But there are groups around the world, within the community, we always share everything. But there are groups around the world in various government centers that are unable to release their code freely to people. But most people do, so the code is open source.
In the good old days, things like computational fluid dynamics was like gobs and gobs of Fortran code. What's the gearing under a modern climate model made of, and do the normal rules of software engineering apply to this type of work?
Basically, that's a great question, because basically historically a lot of these climate models have originated from that gobs and gobs of Fortran code that was done in computational fluid dynamics, except gobs and gobs more Fortran code is added on top. If you go around the world, most climate models are based on Fortran. that's an old language, you know, the later versions of Fortran, and they have preprocessors. That is, you write the actual code itself in Fortran, but you'll have a preprocessor, which is maybe C or some other language, which will pick the bits of code and put the model together based on what you're trying to look at, the question you're trying to look at. For example, maybe you don't really need to look at, you know, sea ice processes if you're focusing specifically on what's going over the Sahara. So you might just, in the processor, pick bits of code that are relevant to the problem in question. So there are hundreds of thousands of lines long now. These things are huge, and they are Fortran, and a lot of this modern software engineering is kind of, you know, happening, but not in climate modeling. Although now we've had to take advantage of the parallel processing machines to really get our speed up. So you know, the parallelizing, vectorizing your code, paralyzing the as well, is becoming more and more the norm.
That kind of leads to another question I had, which is that climate modeling is notorious for requiring massive supercomputing resources. Is the existence of the new distributed computing efforts, such as the Boeing from Stanford, which is being used for drug research and for SETI at home and things like that, changing the game about who has the resources to do large-scale modeling?
Well, often it's a question of priorities of the government du jour, whether or not there are the resources to look at some area of science. I mean, in Canada, the where I am, the federal government over previous years have spent a lot in ensuring that the computers are state of the art, the IBM systems right now. In NCAR, some have used Cray or NEC supercomputing systems. So I would say that the limitation is the existence of computer power is not a limitation. The limitation is the desire of those who hold the purse strings to actually allocate the resources for a particular branch of science over another branch. So you know, it depends basically on the issue du jour, actually.
Is the problem right now more compute bound or model bound in the sense of?
Interesting. I think it's in the U.S. It's probably a little bit of both. It used to be in the U.S. compute bound until very recently, until a very massive procurement happened for NCAR in the U.S. Where now, it's less compute bound and more the combination of the two. So I think that, and that's true over most of the parts of the world, that now it's going hand in hand as you understand the physics more and more, and you want to include better and better representation of the physics. You need more and more computing power to be able to do so. So it's working in tandem. So I would say it's not bounded by either one by itself, but by the combination of the two.
How do you validate the correctness of climate models in the sense that short-term weather predictions can be validated against next year's hurricanes and blizzards? You can see if they track the way you think they will. But a climate model really can't be validated that way, because by the time you have enough data to validate it, you'd already be decades into the target period.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. So again, the validation process in the climate model is very complicated. It's, first of all, each of the individual components of that model are historically validated. That is, the ocean component will be validated in looking at ocean examples. The atmospheric component could be validated in as much as, you know, in numerical weather prediction procedures. There's not much differences between the atmospheric component of climate models and numerical weather prediction models, just much coarser resolution. So how do you, when you put it all together, how do you validate that? Well, the way you do it is a number of ways. One is you look at the statistics of the variability, and you compare the statistics of the variability in the model to the statistics of the variability in nature. What I mean by that is that we're not, by its very definition, is the statistics of weather. We can't look at the weather in the climate model, but we can look at how it represents the El Nino Southern Oscillation, how the global signature of that variability looks, and how that looks to years when we have El Niños. We can also then look at the kind of mean climatology and the seasonal cycle. How does the sea ice grow and disappear on any given year from in the summer versus the winter? That's looking at a validation of the seasonal cycle, which is a very component of these models. We can look at validation of precipitation fields, climatological fields with our climatological data network. We can look historically, take our models and run them back in time, run them back to periods when prior to, you know, civilization, last glacial maximum and others, and see whether the large-scale features that are inferred by the proxy paleo record are captured in the climate model, things like a reduction of the strength of the sinking in the North Atlantic in the last glacial maximum, things like an expanse of ice sheets in the last glacial maximum, things like pollen records would suggest various temperatures in the last glacial maximum. Same thing in terms of the mid-Holocene, when there was a slight warm period. You'd want to look at that too. And then you can also examine the transient evolution of the climate system from 1850 or from pre-industrial times to today and compare the transient evolution of what we have seen to that which the models say we should have seen. That is, that's called hindcasting. So at a combination of these, you come up with a understanding of how good or bad or average your particular climate model is.
I'd like to move on now to the work you did with the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. That document must have been a delicate one to write. It's one of those places where science and politics and geopolitics become inseparable. What are the realities of trying to produce a consensus document in that kind of an environment?
It's actually a fascinating procedure and process to be part of. I mean, it's truly the most comprehensive, thoroughly reviewed, rigorous scientific assessment process I've ever heard of and certainly been part of. I mean, this happens over the many, many years. I mean, it's about three to even pushing four years from beginning to end of the whole process. In fact, we're starting now for the next one that'll happen in a few years. I mean, the first meeting is going to happen in February of coming up. So what happens then is you a bunch of scientists covering various areas of the climate system get together and are tasked with writing a chapter. They have to go out and survey all the literature, come back, put it together, argue amongst themselves as to priorities or lack thereof, contact colleagues in the field, get their input, and put together a very, very skeletal zero-thwarted draft, which is then sent out to the wider membership of those writing the IPCC report. That they get the feedback from that and then put together the first draft. That first draft is then sent out to experts around the world, and literally thousands and thousands of comments come in. And you have to respond to all of these comments, and that then gives you revise your manuscript in as a group to deal with the comments. It goes out for review a second time, and more comments come back, and then you revise again. Within a group, there's probably maybe 10 authors of a chapter. Now, to get consensus there is actually pretty easy, ironically. I mean, sure, there's arguments, but consensus, you know, we don't argue whether gravity exists. We might argue a little bit about whether or not one paper, the assumptions underlying the analysis conducted in a paper, scientific manuscript that we're assessing, were actually valid in the context they were. And so, you know, it's not actually that difficult. Scientists typically are able to reach consensus on these topics. Sometimes it's delicate. And there is no political interference at that stage. The only political issues come at the final plenary when because this is a document that's subject to UN regulations, the summary for policymakers has to be approved word for word unanimously by every member state. And that is where, you know, special interests start to rear their ugly head.
That's where you get the beyond a certain, you know, 95% certainty, 90% certainty.
Well, no, that's where you will get the decisions as to the certainty. Those are based on chapters. So those are based on discussions within chapters and the feedback we get from the international community through the peer review system. At the actual final plenary, you will have governments who are unable to change the science. The regulations will not allow them to change the scientific content. But they can question, you know, the certainty or question inclusion or deletion of certain bits. So you might find that some special interests would not like, you know, this to be said. So they'll raise that there. But by and large, that it ends up getting approved much in the same form as it was originally submitted, but there's just some negotiations that happen in the final plenary.
Many people consider the IPCC paper to be a wake-up call to world governments that the time for denial is over. Do you think it was a sea change, or do you think it's going to be a blip on the way?
Well, I mean, what I find interesting about the issue of global warming is that unlike many other environmental issues out there, but very similar to the ozone depletion issue of 30 years ago, the people speaking the loudest or calling, you know, who you will typically see, you know, speaking out about it are scientists working in the area. It's not the kind of typical, environmental movement who are leading the charge. Well, certainly they're supportive and they're very, but you've got the scientists doing standing up and saying we need to deal with this. So we've been saying that for a long time. I don't know why, still to this day, don't know why the IPCC report in 2007 had so much impact. Perhaps it was because of it followed shortly after, you know, Al Gore's Inconvenient Truth. Perhaps it was because Hurricane Katrina hit the U.S. Perhaps it was because of other international weather-related events or climate-related events. Nobody quite knows. But certainly there was a public awareness and willingness to actually take this and recognize, oh, yes, we need to start to deal with this.
A common criticism of efforts to curb carbon emissions in the U.S. is that with Asia's carbon output exploding, significant reductions in the West will become insignificant. Apart from the two wrongs don't make a right argument, what is the real incentive for the industrialized nations to cut carbon output?
Well, it's a great question, because I'm in Canada. That's basically the single most important reason that is touted as for a reason why Canada doesn't want to actually do anything. Well, first of all, number one, a lot of the growth in a lot of the emissions in Asia, for example, are associated with the goods that we consume in America and Canada. So it's not quite fair to say that all their emissions are internal. They're not. There's a lot of external emissions associated with our consumption here and the production of the goods afar. So number two is, though, if you look, the atmosphere actually cares about not so much the emissions in any given year, but the cumulative emissions of carbon dioxide. That is, the carbon cycle is such that what matters is the total amount of human-emitted carbon dioxide that's put into the atmosphere. If you actually compare since pre-industrial times, 80% of the amount of emissions is coming from 20% of the world's population. That is, 80% of the emissions is coming from essentially the developed world. Now China is certainly coming on board, but I would view that, rather than viewing that as a negative, as a huge opportunity. What is happening here is China is improving their standard of living. Every single person in China is a consumer of energy, and every single person in China will want to be a consumer of energy that is not producing emissions once we, who have the economic and technological wherewithal to develop those solutions, get a move on. So I view it rather than it, you know, taking this as a negative, viewing this as what a business opportunity this will be when we have a marketplace. Can you imagine if we in North America had designed the electric cars like the hybrids, but to 100% electric, and we're now marketing them in China? Could you imagine the people in China are buying cars, in India they're buying cars? What an opportunity! Instead, what's happening is our car manufacturers are suffering, because they made a strategic decision to go and build big cars a number of decades ago, whereas in Japan, they're building these hybrids that people are buying left, right, and center, and they're making gobs of money. So, you know, you have to recognize that the world is going to move towards reducing emissions. So we can either be leaders and develop and use that as an opportunity, a catalyst for change to steer our economy in a way to take advantage of that, or we can do more of the same. But what is more of the same giving us? More of the same is giving us look around. That's your local bank, the credit crunch that's happening, and so on and so forth. It's telling us now we need to think about doing things differently. And I would argue that would be mirroring the economy and the environment together, to look at using the environment as a means or as a catalyst to actually spur the economy in new directions that are less fossil fuel intensive.
When the average person hears about a 3-degree rise in temperature over the next century, it may not sound that bad. You know, especially if you're paying for fuel oil in the Northeast right now. What does 3 degrees translate to on the ground? Is it an extinction level event, or is it just something that's going to make, just is not the right term, is it something that's going to make life miserable for us and unlivable for many?
3-degree warming, if you're, you know, in some parts of the world, like you might think, well, okay, let me just take a look at my winter and it's -5, -3 degrees, -2. Doesn't work that way, okay? What 3 degrees, first of all, is amplified, it's a global average, it's amplified where the feedbacks in the climate system are strongest. So that means the warming is actually amplified in high latitudes. But it's not only warming, it's as you move the whole system towards warmer temperatures, you're changing the statistics of weather about the mean climate as well. What does that mean? For example, the likelihood of say, 5 days of 39 degree weather in Chicago is, you know, whatever it is today. If you warm the whole climate system up by 3 degrees, well, you know, now you're talking about a likelihood of 42 degrees. And at those extremes, that's a big difference when you start to move up, that you move up those extremes more and more. It's the same with precipitation. U.S. has got a bit of a problem right now, because if you look at the where it's getting its water from, a lot of it's coming in southern U.S. from High Plains Aquifer, which is actually not being replenished at the rate water's being extracted. So you have in the projections an increased drying of the subtropical latitudes, including southern U.S. So this means that water becomes more and more available. But with population growing and water going down, you start to see some problems there. So it's not only about warming in that context. It's about warming as it affects water. In terms of species, 3-degree warming is, you know, this means widespread. And I don't mean, you know, 10%. I'm talking above 25% committing to extinction of 25%, more than 25% of all species on the planet. I mean, this is huge. This is these are big changes. So you know, it's also start to get with 3 degrees. What does that mean? It means we've passed the point of no return for Greenland and likely West Antarctica. Actually, 6 meters from Greenland, 6 from West Antarctica or so, or 5 from West Antarctica. We're committing ourselves to many meters of sea level rise. It won't happen overnight. It'll take centuries. But you know, that's a real problem if you live in Holland. I mean, what is 11 meters of sea level rise going to do to you in Holland? Well, it means you don't have a country anymore. So then, is that good for me sitting comfortably at 3 degrees above warming in my house in New York? Well, no, I've now got, you know, millions of Dutch people who are saying, hey, you know, what are you going to do with me? So, you know, but this is, it's all around the world like this. So to me, the biggest problem is, you know, environmental refugees will be a very great problem. And again, this sows the seeds for discontent, because it's not in many parts of the world that do not have the ability to adapt. Economic ability, they're also not the ones who caused the problem. So they're going to be looking to us and saying, well, heck, you caused the problem. You know, what are you going to do about it? So I think it really is this is a huge issue that I think we need to deal with, because if, you know, you could frame it in terms of national security, you could frame it in terms of internal security through, water availability, you can frame it through just, you know, mortality and of species, or even human comforts extreme weather events. So all of the above are reasons why we need to act now.
The more we study global climate, the more carbon tipping points we seem to be encountering, things like the biomass trapped in the Arctic tundra. Just today, the World Wildlife Federation released a statement that they think we may be past the point of no return for polar sea ice. Do you think these tipping points or ones yet unknown may cause an unexpectedly rapid acceleration of global warming? And are you trying to incorporate them into new models as you go along?
I think you'd find that first of all, most people in the community would agree that Arctic sea ice in the summer is gone. We can't stop that, because it's going to happen anyway. It's going to go ice-free because of the fact that we've got so much warming in store because of the missions we've already done. But in terms of feedbacks, this is a great unknown. What we do know is, we know, for example, as the frozen soil, the permafrost thaws, you expose organic material to oxygen, or if there's water on top, no oxygen. And in either way case, it decays, and that decay will add another form of greenhouse gases. So the question, we know the sign of that feedback is positive. It does accelerate the warming, but we don't know the magnitude, and we don't know the stability of some of these northern regions. So you know, I don't think that this is a huge area of unknown right now. So it's something that the scientific community is trying to grapple with, to try to get a handle on the magnitude. We know the sign, but what the magnitude is. So this is also why we have more uncertainty as to the upper bound of warming this century, as opposed to the lower bound, which we're much more confident in. I'm an optimist. I think we'll recognize long before we have to pass these kind of methane or carbon thresholds that we've solved this problem. Like we did and rose to the challenge for chlorofluorocarbons back in early 1990s with the Montreal Protocol.
So finally, I'd like to turn a little bit to your recent work doing climate projections for Discovery's Project Earth. First of all, how did you come to be involved in that project?
Well, it's interesting. I know exactly what happened. Is the Discovery Channel had decided they were going to look at some of these geoengineering projects. And so then they contacted, after they'd done this, they contacted a couple of people. And I think one of them was they contacted people at NOAA, in fact, NOAA in GFDL in Princeton, and asked them if they could run some experiments for them. But NOAA, the GFDL model is an outstanding climate model, one of the best, if not the best in the world. But it can't run these experiments overnight, because it's it takes an awful lot of computing power and also there's national interests at stake here. They have to be careful. But they recommended then that they contact us because we have a climate model which is a little simpler atmosphere which is designed to look at these kind of what if experiments. It doesn't resolve individual weather processes like the NOAA one does, but it looks at the statistics of the phenomenon. So then they just contacted us and said, hey, what do you want? And we were deeply suspicious to begin with and checked out, just deeply suspicious of the intent. But after some research, I mean, this is the same company that did Walking with Dinosaurs. We felt, we can do this as long as our caveats are expressed as to what we believe are the ethical questions of actually dealing with these geoengineering problems.
How much of the work you did with the show involved developing new models, and how much was just plugging different parameters into models you already had?
It was 100% us taking emission scenarios or albedo changes or engineering fixes that were prescribed to us based on the people in the field, and us using our existing climate model that has been validated and evaluated against the existing, everything we do is based on this. And then just running it with different input. It was not building new models. It was all about running what we had there.
The series seemed to provide a more in-depth analysis of benefit and risks compared to typical science content on television. But at the end of the day, it still seemed to me to have a kind of Amazing Race, Mythbusters flavor to it, in that they had short time frames to test the projects. They had a kind of an emphasis on the drama of the experiments. They did a lot of one-shot trials. Do you think you can do good science under those types of conditions? And do you think that the data that they collected was in any way valid?
Well, I think I was actually pretty impressed at, I don't know what their budget was, at some of the things they did. I mean, they didn't obviously have a goal of writing scientific papers in it. But, I mean, I would, in talking to them, I understand that they built a carbon scrubber with David Keith in Calgary here that actually worked. Which is a good thing. That's a piece of technology that I think you'll find a lot of people think is a good one, where you actually take carbon out of the atmosphere and store it underground. Then they start to mess around with clouds, and they actually had these, big cloud experiments. But a lot of these things, I think it's actually a fascinating show or series of shows, in as much as it puts out the whole questions out there, because people have to recognize that we have one planet. It's getting warmer. You might deny that it is or it isn't, but the fact is it is. We know that. The scientific community has known that for a long time. We are going to have troubles unless we do one of two things. One is cut our emissions, which I think is the right approach, or two is we start to play around with Mother Nature, which is the geoengineering approach. You see the kind of GWOW things that they're doing. Well, they'll think about that on a massive scale, and frankly, it scares the patoobies out of me because, I can imagine putting these reflectors out in space and them being stuck to reflect sunlight. And in the show, we found that if you put too many in, you take us back to kind of mini ice age conditions. I don't think that's the right approach. It's a dangerous approach. It's a hubris approach. We are somehow masters of our planet. I don't think we can control everything like we want to. And so I think the best approach is to reduce emissions. But I think it allows the discussion to take place, and I think it's important that discussion take place, because really there are two options. One is reduce emissions, or two is this geoengineering. And frankly, I don't like a lot of these geoengineering ideas.
That leads into the question I was about to ask, which is, of the solutions you got involved in, which one do you consider the most promising, and which one scares the bejeebers out of you?
Well, the most promising one, without a question, was the carbon scrubbers one. And I actually think that that's a good idea. Because, for example, the carbon scrubbers, what they did there is develop a mechanism to actually take carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, take it out and store it and capture it. So you might argue that that's basically the inverse of what we've been doing as humans. As humans, we've been putting it in, and we could take it right back out. So to me, that makes a lot of sense there. Because it's not making or messing around with Mother Nature directly. It's kind of taking out the problem there. So I think that does have a lot of hope. And you might even imagine, for example, that being done in parallel with an airline industry, which I have a lot of difficulty thinking of off-the-shelf solutions for jet fuel. But you might imagine that you could capture something like that in with jet fuel, and you might get somewhere. The scary one is putting these shiny mirrors in space. I mean, oh my goodness. I think that's, that, you know, messing around with the amount of sunlight we have coming in from space is not something I want to, be part of. So I don't think that that was right. Again, you can imagine it being stuck on all these umbrellas, stuck on reflect mode and suddenly we're reflecting with solar radiation for back to space. Nah, let's not go there.
Yeah, it strikes me as a hard thing to turn off quickly.
Yeah, exactly. Precisely. Whereas the scrubber is a good one. And planting trees, you know, well, there's nothing wrong with planting trees. It didn't have, as you saw in the series, it didn't have a lot of effect, but it is a means of mitigation. It can't account for all the emissions we've done, but there is, you know, that's always a good thing. Plant some trees, you know, it looks nice. You're helping nature, you're building biodiversity. So that's a good thing.
Last question I've got for you. The carbon establishment, as it were, seems to have altered its approach over the last few years, moving from a there's no proof the Earth is warming stance to it's warming, but there's nothing we can do about it. As the series itself points out, many of the schemes could be used as an excuse to slow down, not to slow down carbon output, because we're just going to fix it technologically. Is there a little bit of a damned if you do, damned if you don't aspect to this kind of research, because doing this research could deflect attention from reducing carbon production?
You know, I don't buy those arguments that there's nothing we can do about it. I simply do not buy that. And the example I use is from Canada, and you probably have similar examples in the U.S. But here's an example: in Canada, any electric car is classified as a low speed vehicle, an LSV vehicle. Transport Canada sets regulations that does not allow these LSVs to go more than 40 kilometers an hour. The reason why is that they say they haven't passed the same safety tests. Okay, well then you're not allowed to drive on any city streets in Canada a car that doesn't make 50 kilometers an hour. What we have there is a catch-22. We have regulation ensuring that these things don't drive more than 40 kilometers an hour, because then it beats in with regulations that doesn't let them on the streets unless they drive 50 kilometers an hour. We have so much protectionism out there of existing kind of technologies that I think we need to be dealing with this as a society and saying, you know what, this isn't a free market. This is a regulated market, one that's regulated in favor of the status quo. So I mean, big oil money will want the status quo, because big oil money is there to produce profits for its shareholders, and its shareholders want big oil to be used. So, but you know, we have to move beyond that, and we can do that by creating a level playing field for other companies, and also as consumers by looking what we buy and asking the question, you know, what is the carbon footprint of this product, and guiding these corporations through our own consumption and behavior.
I actually want to follow up on that very quickly. If you think about big oil, for example, certainly one of the poster childs for it during most of its life has been people like T-Bone Pickens. Do you think it's significant that you're starting to see them move, at least publicly, to look more at alternative energy sources?
I think so. I think that people who are running big oil companies and big oil corporations, they're in the energy business. They're there to make money. They're not there to, if they see a wind of change, you know, they might, on the one hand, make it look like they don't want the change to be regulated by governments, but you can bet these people are looking out for alternatives. The wind power in Texas, for example, where's the leader in North America? It's Texas in wind power. You know, Calgary in Canada and Alberta in Canada is taking the lead here. So I, you know, as an optimist, I think we are moving in that direction, and I think just the sooner and the faster the better. I mean, if nothing else, we don't have an unlimited supply of oil, and a lot of that supply is in from parts of the world that are not the most stable these days. So why would we want to rely on oil from these parts of the world? Why wouldn't we embrace, you know, these renewables? And I actually put nuclear power as not a renewable, but certainly as an interim energy source that I think we should be looking at very seriously, because the emissions of carbon are zero, and what we do is we have a storage problem, but that's a local problem that we have to contain in our backyard, and we're not, you know, relying on someone else to deal with our problem.